atmosphere too. Okay, so the differences we see in composition kind of make sense. And the composition of Venus and Mars is probably giving us a good hint as to what the atmosphere of the early Earth was. So probably, I mean, you can kind of move this up, right? So there is 30 times as much carbon dioxide as nitrogen in Venus's atmosphere, and presumably early in the Earth's atmosphere, there was 30 times as much nitrogen, carbon dioxide as there was nitrogen. So it was a much more substantial carbon dioxide atmosphere, which allowed the Earth to remain above freezing mostly when the sun was 30% dimmer, as it was 4 billion years ago. Both Mars and Venus are dry. The cause on Mars is probably mostly just that it's cold, so the water is in the form of ice as opposed to liquid water, so it's hard to find. But also the low escape velocity is probably going to allow the water to escape. Those things aren't gonna, so for Mars, the surface pressure is kind of like this, and water goes directly from ice to a water vapor without going through liquid water. So Earth's pressure is at this level, so we can have solid, liquid, and vapor at various temperatures. That isn't gonna explain Venus. Evaporating the water doesn't get rid of it, just puts it in the atmosphere. And we think what happened is kind of a complicated process in which the water was lost from the planet. So Venus has pretty much the same escape velocity as Earth, so it's not clear how we could lose it directly as water. But what happens is Venus's atmosphere is warm enough that we get water in the UV light of the sun, and the UV light destroys molecules, it breaks apart the hydrogen and the oxygen. The hydrogen can escape, and of course the oxygen is going to end up in rocks. So one imagines that early on Venus had more water than it has now, and there's various evidences for that. In terms of circulation, Venus's circulation is kind of nothing like the Earth's, and it's no surprise because effectively there's no Coriolis force because Venus has a very slow rotation rate. So instead of having, for example, 3 Hadley cells per hemisphere, it looks like there's 1 Hadley cell per hemisphere that goes kind of from equator to pole, and we have a very strong equatorial jet that's blowing in the same direction that the planet is rotating, so it's called the superrotating jet. Takes about 4 days to go around the planet. And what kind of explains that is what's called cyclotropic balance, that is to say where it's the centrifugal force that is balancing the pressure differences that come about because of the horizontal temperature differences. But exactly what can maintain that is kind of up in the air. It turns out that lots of planets have equatorial jets, most of which are superrotating, but some of them aren't superrotating, and there really isn't a great explanation for any of them. So Mars does have pretty much the same sort of meteorology as the Earth has, of course, tuned down because there's much less atmosphere. So we don't have the sort of clouds that we see on Earth. Typical picture of Mars will show no clouds, but there are some, and we looked at pictures of them. The absence of cloud is mostly due to the cold, so the water vapor never gets a chance to get up there. There are high and low pressure systems and the usual sorts of flows around them, but everything is very muted because of the low pressure. In terms of the Hadley cells, it's similar but different from the Earth. In the Earth, so first of all, it's maybe worth remembering that the seasons are like the seasons on the Earth. They are modified by the distance that the planet is from the sun. Except for Mars, that's a big difference as opposed to a relatively minor difference for the Earth. So the northern hemisphere has somewhat moderate seasons because when it's winter in the northern hemisphere, that's when Mars is 10% closer to the sun. When it's summer in the northern hemisphere, that's when Mars is 10% further away from the sun. So the southern hemisphere has much more extreme seasons than the northern hemisphere, and the whole seasonal effects are generally speaking larger. So on Earth, when we have summer in the say northern hemisphere, it turns out that the balance point of the so-called equatorial Hadley cells moves towards the winter hemisphere. But that is very exaggerated in the in Mars, so we basically have this equator spanning hemisphere. And of course, in the winter hemisphere, we still have pretty much the same sort of effects that we've seen, a strong jet that's flowing from the west. And it turns out there's this weak eastward flowing jet in the summer hemisphere. So it's so weak that it's actually reversed there in the southern hemisphere. At equinox, things are very much the way they are in the Earth, with Hadley cells rising up from the equators, two jets on either side. Pretty similar situation to what we have with the Earth. Much less evident, again, because of the absence of clouds. And here, of course, is the situation in Venus, where instead of having multiple Hadley cells, as I say, in books at least, three Hadley cells per hemisphere, but this is showing kind of a more reasonable point of view that it's more complicated than that, and kind of only on average are there three Hadley cells. Whereas on Venus, we've got pole to equator Hadley cells. So the presence of signs of liquid water that we talked about two times ago, right, the flow features on Mars, indicates that not only did the temperature have to be hotter on Venus in order on Mars in order to have liquid water, but there had to be more atmosphere total. Right? We have to get above this triple point of water in order to have any liquid water present. So we need presumably a lot more carbon dioxide. There is carbon dioxide that's in these polar ice caps. It's actually hard to put enough together to get above the triple point of water, but it must have happened. Because we sure see those signs of flowing water. Questions on terrestrial planet meteorology? So Venus has this huge greenhouse effect because it has this hugely thick atmosphere. Well, maybe as good a way as any to start talking about, why don't you get those ones there, to start talking about the giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, is going to be to take a look at some pictures. So we saw Jupiter through the telescope. We can do a lot better from Hubble, and we can do even better yet if we have... So this wasn't working before, but there's this nice Google-provided ability to move around on the planet of Mars, and you have these nice kind of three-dimensional views. So I invite you to play with that sometime to get a good feeling for what the big rift valleys look like and what the mountains look like. But unfortunately, it wasn't working when we were talking about geology. Okay, so this is a Hubble Space Telescope picture of Jupiter. And what we can see is that we have bands on the planets. So the white parts are called zones, and the dark parts are called belts, and you can see that they are somewhat symmetrically located around the equator. And we have all of this interesting flow stuff, and we'll see movies of this in a second, where we have interactions between these zones and belts. So here's a picture, I think it's a year later, from Hubble Space Telescope. And if you kind of compare these guys, you can see that, you know, Jupiter certainly does change in a year sort of time scale, but it remains having these very interesting flow features and these zones and belts that we're certainly going to want to try and explain. So here's a movie that kind of shows you how things actually change. This was taken by the Pioneer spacecraft as they approached Jupiter, so that's why we're getting closer and closer and closer. The thing is, Jupiter is, of course, actually rotating. So what they've done is to put together frames so that this thing here, which is called the Great Red Spot, is more or less in the same position for all of these frames. And you can see that we've got counterclockwise circulation of this Great Red Spot, and it's in the southern hemisphere. So if we work that out, right, so if we've got, well, if we have a high pressure system, because that's what it's going to turn out to be, and we're in the southern hemisphere, things are going to be pushed to the left as they try and escape. So we're going to end up with exactly that sort of counterclockwise circulation. So the Great Red Spot is a high pressure system in the atmosphere of Jupiter. Remember that Jupiter is gas all the way down. So it's not clear where the bottom, if there is a bottom, does this circulation pattern ever stop? There are other things here like these white ovals that, again, one bad thing about this movie is it lets you forget that this whole thing is rotating too. And you can see that these bands of fast moving air are, of course, going to be jet streams that are the result of the thermal wind that's present on Jupiter, just as it is on the... Incidentally, here you can see a low pressure system because things are rotating in the other direction as they are on Jupiter. So around 2000, three of these white ovals got together to form this guy here. So they coalesced into one thing, which then turned red. So that's Red Junior. So Red Junior is so this was a picture that snapped when they happened to be close to the big red spot, to the Great Red Spot. It has, you know, a separate location, you know, just as two hurricanes on Earth would have a separate location. And you can see it's lasted so far for 12 years. The Great Red Spot, we think, was spotted 300 years ago, so it seems to be a very long-lived feature in Jupiter's atmosphere. So we'll kind of see how long Red Junior survives in this kind of turbulent place that is Jupiter. Well, so maybe we'll do a little bit of Saturn. So we'll look at more typical pictures of Saturn in a minute, but usually Saturn lacks this feature here. So that's a storm that kind of popped up through the hazy layer of Saturn and was visible for a while. And these things happen occasionally, kind of every 20 years. We see cases where we can see more interesting features on Saturn than we can typically. So a more typical picture of Saturn. Here's a picture of Saturn from Hubble Space. So you can see that there is similar sort of banding on Saturn as there is on Jupiter, except it's much more muted. And the colors are kind of more yellowish as opposed to red and whitish, the way we saw on Jupiter. Well, this will work, I guess. And if we look at, so that was from Hubble. If we look at a spacecraft that went by recently, so this was Cassini, same sort of pretty muted colors. And of course, Saturn has this big ring system. All of the giant planets have rings, but Saturn's is by far the most visible and obvious. We're not going to be talking about it particularly today. Yeah. So just for comparison, this is one of many. This is the largest of Saturn's many moons. And you can see the nice shadow of the ring on this pattern. So it's going to turn out particularly for Jupiter, but for all the giant planets, they have this structure that goes around the planet, as opposed to having the sort of structure that we see, you know, in a typical picture from space of Earth, where we see these separate high and low pressure systems with their corresponding circulations. What we see on the giant planets is kind of high and low pressure systems that have been twisted all the way around the planet by the much stronger Coriolis force. And here's what we think is basically going on. We have Hadley cells that are running, multiple of them, between equator and pole. And so we have regions of uplift. So we have warm air that is rising and cold air that is falling. And just as exactly with the thermal wind in the Earth, because this is warm air, it has a lower density. So the pressure changes less at altitude than it does in this cold air. So we have a high pressure system here and a low pressure system there. And that pressure difference is going to drive through the geostrophic approximation a strong wind in the boundary between the zone and the belt. Okay, so it's kind of no different from our jet stream, except we've got multiple of them spread out because we have multiple Hadley cells going from top to bottom through Jupiter. Now there's lots of potential confusion for this zone and belt picture of Jupiter. And I think some of that confusion is in our book. So I've described this as warm air that's rising. And so what's going to be happening is, I'll call it moist air, but the things that are going to be condensing out of Jupiter's atmosphere are, at these altitudes, not so much going to be water, but they're going to be other sorts of clouds. So low down in Jupiter's atmosphere, we have water clouds, and then we've got ammonium sulfate clouds, and then we've got ammonia clouds. Because these things condense out at different temperatures and pressure. So ammonia we think of as being more of a gas, but if you get to these sorts of temperatures, we can have clouds of ammonia, whereas water is going to condense out at these sorts of temperatures. Okay, but as this air rises successively, different things will condense out of the atmosphere as we go colder and colder and colder through this adiabatic lapse rate that goes along with convection. So as a result, what's going to happen is we're going to kind of squeegee out the ammonia and the condensables in this air before it turns over into this belt. So the tops of the zones are going to be higher and automatically going to be colder than the belts. Okay, so that's seeming contradiction, right? So here I talked about warm air rising, but if we look at the temperature of these clouds compared to the temperature of those clouds, these clouds are going to be colder. Okay, and they're colder because they're higher. Once this air has been squeegeed clean of all of its ammonia, when it comes over here to condense, it's going to have to go to a much lower level before we start to get condensation. So the ammonia isn't going to condense out until we reach this sort of level. So we have this overturn of warm air that actually measures cold and cold air that actually measures warm, simply based on different altitudes of the corresponding clouds. And the same thing also applies to the Great Red Spot. We see the same phenomena on Earth in hurricanes. So I hope you know that hurricanes are low pressure systems. So if we had a low pressure system in the southern hemisphere, of course, what we're going to have is a pressure force that is going to be pushing from high pressure to low. So we need a Coriolis force that is going the other way. So we're going to have the wind blowing this way because the Coriolis force pushes to the left. And we're going to end up with air circulating around like this. But the center of a hurricane, even though it's a low pressure system, it's warm. And so even though it's low, as we go up above sea level in a hurricane, the pressure is going to drop slower in the low pressure system than it's going to drop in the area around it. So if we go up high enough, the central low pressure will become a high pressure, and the winds will circulate in the other direction. Okay? These odd reversals. So we actually see this in the largest of Earth-sized hurricanes, and the best guess is that's exactly what's going on in the Great Red Spot. That if we could, which we can't, if we could see deep into the Great Red Spot, that high pressure system would become a low pressure system, a hurricane equivalent, and we'd have the winds going the other way around it. So low pressure system leading to a high pressure system at altitude is one possible explanation for what's going on with the Great Red Spot. Early on, people thought that the Great Red Spot might correspond to some sort of surface feature, you know, maybe some mountain or something like that. And there are lots of reasons why that's not going to be the case. Right. One of the reasons, of course, is there's nothing going to be solid on the surface of Jupiter. But also, it turns out that the Great Red Spot does move around in longitude. Now, how can I make that sort of statement? What's going to define longitude on a planet that doesn't have a solid surface? Right. We can't see where the Great Red Spot is compared to Greenwich, England. Of course, Greenwich, England is moving around at centimeters per year because of plate tectonics, but for all intents and purposes, is fixed. What's going to define our longitude on an all gaseous planet? And the answer is the magnetic field of the planet. So our guess is that the magnetic field has its origin deep inside the planet, and that it's rotating with the same speed that the core of the planet is rotating on. And so we can measure things relative to the location of the magnetic field on Jupiter. Notice that Jupiter's magnetic field is reversed compared to our magnetic field. The odd statement that our North Pole is a South Pole we've talked about before. And for Jupiter, a compass on the an Earth compass taken to Jupiter would be pointing south. The red hand would be pointing south as opposed to north. And presumably that switches around, but on a millions of year time scale, so that it's never been observed. So what's kind of the cause of this magnetic field on Jupiter? And for the rest of the looking ahead, for the rest of the superior planets also. What we know we need for a magnetic field is a convecting fluid. And on all the planets we've talked about, that conducting convecting fluid has been iron. And there probably is iron on Jupiter, but it's going to be all crushed to the core, which is very small change compared to the rest of the planet. So we're thinking that the conducting convecting fluid is not, in fact, iron. It's going to be something else. I guess I didn't get out my interiors because I'm not sure I found my interiors. So Jupiter, best guess is it's going to be made out of the same sort of stuff that the Sun is made out of, which is mostly hydrogen and helium. It's massive enough that it's not going to, its escape velocity is so huge that it's not, that the material is not going to escape from the inside. So mostly hydrogen and helium all the way down, probably built around a rock. So we're going to have an iron core, but surrounding it and representing, well, more than 99% of the mass of Jupiter is going to be stuff that is mostly hydrogen and helium. And we don't think of hydrogen as being a conducting fluid. We think of it as being a gas, right? Hydrogen isn't shiny. Shininess is the characteristic of any conducting material. What's going on? Well, if you remember your periodic table, hydrogen really is in the same spot as all those metals. So it should act like those metals if it could be in solid form at high enough pressure. And that's exactly what we've got in Jupiter, extremely high pressure. So instead of having this conducting convecting fluid be liquid iron, we think that it's metallic hydrogen. So this hydrogen would look shiny the way copper looks. It is just differing from our hydrogen and being highly compressed. And presumably that's the source of the conducting convecting fluid that is at the core of Jupiter. Yeah, I don't know what happened to my core picture. It's not going to materialize. So the picture we've been having for Jupiter is sometimes called the shallow model. And the question is, how deep do these bands and zones go? So for the Earth's atmosphere, of course, they're solid down here at the ground, so there's a big distinction between the atmosphere and the rock. Not so for Jupiter, right? It's, for all intents and purposes, it's liquid all the way down. So do these zones and belts actually go all the way through the planet? And so one possibility is that we have this sort of situation, where zones and belts in the northern hemisphere are actually connected through cylinders of similarly rotating material to zones and belts in the northern hemisphere. And so how could we get information about this sort of situation? Well, we need some sort of evidence for the equivalent of seismic structure for the planet. No chance to put anything on the surface of the planet, but we could make basically submarines, as it were, that would dive deep down into the planet, and we did that. So Galileo was a probe that was sent into the atmosphere of Jupiter, and it returned lots of information that we'll be talking about, but you know, you can only go so far before you're going to get crushed. So it got crushed at about 22 times the atmospheric pressure of the Earth, and it didn't really go deep enough to resolve the... So as far as we could see, as far as it went, these strong winds were maintaining. There was nothing like a non-rotating surface that the Galileo probe saw. But, you know, maybe it happened at 30 atmospheres or 50 atmospheres or 100 atmospheres. We don't really know. So there are proponents of both of those points of view, and I think probably the consensus is that it certainly has to be a bit of both. So one common kind of in-between sort of situation is there might be a core that is not rotating, and that there would be cylinders, that some of which would intersect this non-rotating core, and other cylinders that would—that's a cross section—and other cylinders that would go from top to bottom. So the depth of these rotations is not clear.
Where did the Galileo enter in terms of latitude?
Where?
Yeah.
It turns out to be a really excellent question. So kind of zone or belt is, I take it, the answer that you'd be looking for.
Yeah.
It turns out that even though zone or belt constitutes 99% of the surface area of Jupiter, so you're almost certain to hit one of those, it didn't. It went into an unusually clear area that was neither dark. So it was, in some sense, a very unlucky shot, because what we learned about was not typical of the planet as a whole. And one of the things that was for sure supposed to detect were these cloud layers. And so we have these ammonia clouds, ammonium sulfate clouds, water clouds. It was supposedly nicely detect all of these as it went down, and it didn't. It went into a very clear zone, so it never saw, it did see a little bit of ammonia clouds, but it didn't see any water clouds. So I don't know if it's an experiment that'll be repeated at some time that somebody can go deeper into the atmosphere. But probably in terms of the wind structure, it doesn't matter. Because the area that it went into, this big dark spot, the winds are moving at hundreds of meters a second, and the spot is relatively small. So the spot had to be moving along at the same speed as the winds of the whole planet were going. But in terms of the content that's there, everyone's assuming that it was anomalous, that there really are these unseen water clouds. And of course, they're not seen because the ammonia clouds are opaque. So we just calculate that if Jupiter has the amount of water that we think it should have based on the composition of the sun, there should be water clouds at this level. They're not actually seen or likely to be seen until we go down to those sorts of very low altitudes. And so we need to go 100 kilometers or so below the noticeable cloud levels before we expect to see those water clouds. More questions? So one of the things that Galileo did is it gave us good data on the composition of the atmosphere of Jupiter. And it turns out that to a kind of a first order approximation, Jupiter has the same composition we see for the sun, which is the same composition we see for everything in the universe, more or less, which is in terms of number, about 90% hydrogen and 10% helium. Now, if you look in a really old book, it'll talk about Jupiter having methane and ammonia and things like that. So first of all, those things are absolutely impossible, because you remember that high temperatures break apart composites, and the center of Jupiter is like 50,000 degrees hot. There's a lot of residual heat that's left over from it. So molecules certainly can only exist in the relatively cool outer layers of the atmosphere of Jupiter. It all has to be broken apart if we go deeper down into Jupiter. The reason that people came up with these is that these are substances that have very nice absorption lines. So when we take a spectra of the planet, we can pick those out very easily. We've said before that molecular hydrogen, since it's a homonuclear diatomic, doesn't have much in the way of absorption lines. And helium turns out only to have absorption lines in the strong ultraviolet. And of course, we can't observe those from Earth. So it turns out that the amount of helium is always very difficult to detect, particularly helium. Hydrogen also, but maybe a little bit less so, is always a little bit unsure about, we're always a little bit unsure about its composition. But Galileo actually carried a chemical analyzer with it, so it wasn't based on spectroscopy, but it was based on mass. It could actually detect all of these sorts of compounds. Now, if we look in greater detail, the heavier compounds, like carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen, they're about three times solar. And that makes sense. that you would expect that those low heavier mass constituents would be held on even stronger than the hydrogen is, so they would be advanced a little bit compared to the hydrogen or helium. But overall, it's mostly hydrogen or helium with relatively small impurities of all of the rest of the elements. And it's based on, the sun has iron in it. The iron in the sun hasn't gone to the center, but the iron in Jupiter has sunk to the center, and so that's where the iron is. We wouldn't expect to find iron in the atmosphere of Jupiter. Now, I mentioned before that Jupiter is very hot on the inside. Kind of, what's the basis for that calculation? How do we know how hot it is on the inside? Well, what we can measure is the geological heat flow from the surface of Jupiter. So on the Earth, the heating from literally from the rocks is small change compared to the heating from the sun. So it'd be very hard to detect orbiting the Earth. But exactly the reverse is the case on Jupiter. There's actually more of this geothermal heating than there is solar heating. So it's actually dominating the atmosphere. So you might remember the possibility of nuclear winter, that if we had opaque clouds, it might not get hotter with depth. Well, things are hotter with depth because that's where the furnace is. The center of Jupiter is leaking heat much more than the sun is keeping Jupiter warm. Much more, 50% more than solar heating is doing. And that'll turn out to be true with three of four of the gas giant planets, and certainly true of Saturn also, which is our other topic for today. Okay, yep?
So how come it doesn't ignite?
Ah, so what does ignition require?
It's a reaction.
Well, so hydrogen we think of as a flammable gas, right? The Hindenburg exploded. But it exploded because H2 plus O2 can go to H2O, right? Don't got no oxygen. When I say don't have any oxygen, we have maybe 0.1% oxygen, the same sort of oxygen concentration that we have in the sun. So in some sense, flammable gas, but In order to be inflamed, we need an actual chemical reaction to go. Now, we'll talk about this in the future. The sun is actually powered not by chemical reactions, but by nuclear reactions, by fusion. So why isn't Jupiter fusing hydrogen to helium the way the sun is doing it? Why aren't there nuclear reactions going on in Jupiter? Well, Jupiter's hot, maybe 50,000 degrees, but the sun is like 12 million degrees hot. So Jupiter isn't quite hot enough, well, not by a long shot hot enough, in order to start the reactions that would make it into a star. So Jupiter misses being a star by about a factor of 10. So if Jupiter were 10 times more massive than it is, then it could be a very slowly burning star, as opposed to a slowly cooling off planet. I said that most of Jupiter's energy was left over residual heat, and that's certainly the case, but there are going to be other sources of heating too. Like there is this rock that's at the bottom of Jupiter, and that rock is about 8 times the size of the Earth, so the Earth has radioactive elements, it has radioactive elements. But 8 times bigger than the Earth may sound like a lot, but Jupiter is 300 times the size of the Earth. So the rocky component of Jupiter is small change, and its radioactive energy sources are small change. Probably a bigger source of heating in Jupiter, as I say, most of it's leftover heat, but a bigger source than radioactive energy is probably leftover from differentiation. Right, so on this floor, what differentiation means is the separation of things by density, the heavy stuff falling, the lighter stuff floating. And of course, energy is going to be given up when the heavy stuff sinks. Now, the way heavy stuff has sunk, stuff that we don't think of as heavy helium, it's probably in the process of sinking too. So there's a huge mass difference, a factor of 4, between hydrogen and helium. So even though we think of helium as being light, it's way heavier than hydrogen. And best guess is that it's the Jupiter is in the process of raining out some of that helium. And some of the best evidence for this comes from Saturn. So Saturn is kind of a junior version of Jupiter. It has, roughly speaking, a third of the mass of Jupiter, pretty much the same physical size as Jupiter, so it has a reduced density. So remember we said that Saturn's density was light enough that it would float if you had a bathtub that's big enough, whereas Jupiter's density is 30% more than the density of water. And for Saturn, the helium number density is down by about a factor of 3. Now that number is a little bit uncertain because, remember what I said, the only way we can really be sure of our helium concentration is by actually sending a chemical processing probe in there, because helium just doesn't produce nice absorption lines except in the ultraviolet. And we haven't done that with Saturn. There hasn't been a probe that's entered Saturn's atmosphere the way there has been one probe that's entered Jupiter's atmosphere. But sure looks as if Saturn is deficient in helium, and kind of the natural explanation for that is compared to hydrogen, it's a heavy gas, and it's in the process of differentiating, having that heavy stuff go towards the bottom. So Saturn, like Jupiter, has a magnetic field, and therefore we need a conducting convecting fluid for it, and the best guess is that conducting convecting fluid is like it is on Jupiter. Where's my magnetic field? Here it is. So here's the magnetic field of Saturn. Best guess is that the pressures on Saturn are enough to create this liquid metallic hydrogen. And so we have that as our conducting convecting fluid. That's the source of Saturn's magnetic field. Incidentally, Saturn's magnetic field is a little bit unusual because it's kind of too perfect. You might know that the Earth's magnetic pole is separated from the Earth's geographic north pole, and that's generally speaking the case, right? So for Saturn, there's the same sort of deviation between North magnetic pole and the spin axis as there is on Earth. Not so for Saturn's. So Saturn's magnetic pole and its spin axis are quite aligned. If we look ahead, we see that the sometimes called ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, have pretty unusual magnetic fields in that they are off-center and not particularly well aligned at all with the spin axis of the planet. And we'll say in the end that the source of this big difference between Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune has to do with the presence or absence of this liquid metallic hydrogen. These guys are big, like 10 times bigger, 10 times more massive than the Earth is, but they're not massive enough to have the pressures that are required to make the liquid metallic hydrogen. So our best guess is that the source of the conducting convecting fluid in these guys is not liquid metallic hydrogen. It's got to be something else, but that's a topic for the next day. Questions about Jupiter and Saturn? So we've got data on the wind speeds of these guys. So here's Jupiter with these constantly reversing zonal winds with many, many, many reversals and a strong equatorial jet. And here's Saturn with an astoundingly big equatorial jet, way bigger than any of the other planets. So we're talking about what are supersonic speeds for Saturn, and fewer reversals as we go through the atmosphere of Saturn. So the cause of these big equatorial jets, not exactly clear. So these are both super-rotating equatorial jets, much like Venus, but here we have this pattern of reversals that indicates multiple Hadley cells and multiple zones and belts which are visible on Jupiter, and we just saw maybe vaguely visible on Saturn, but much more muted because there is a haze layer on Saturn. So we're not seeing deep enough to see these colored bands. So the white that we see and the haze that we see on Saturn, that's ammonia that's causing the causing that white color. What's causing the red color on Jupiter is not clear. We can't reproduce it in our labs. It's almost certainly a sulfur compound, but there are a wide range of sulfur compounds that are colorful, and no one has a good match to what exactly that color is. We'll see, incidentally, that the colors of Uranus and Neptune are pretty blue, pretty much being identical blue sorts of balls. And that blue is due to methane in the atmosphere of Uranus and Neptune. Again, not a principal component of the atmosphere of Jupiter. Okay, so I think I'll call it quits there, and then we'll go on to Uranus and Neptune, which are covered not in the next chapter, but in chapter 14. Then we'll come back and talk about the rings and the moons of all of these guys. Oh, I wanted to say one other thing about this thing. So one of the things you have to do are measure angles, and your life will be easier if you pick up, unless you have your own protractor, you can have one of these protractors in order to make those measurements. So you need that for home lab too, to measure those angles at various times. So if you want to pick these up now, that's fine. Otherwise, they'll be sitting outside my office to be picked up. I hope I didn't advertise this more than I can provide.
Thank you.